Blog Talk Radio.
Medicine Cabinet, Monday night, same night as every night. We'll start off by saying this is brought to you by Literary Underground for, I don't know how many people are involved now. Next week's guest will be R.D. Armstrong of Lummox Press. But tonight we have Neil McRae. So instead of me telling you about his book, we'll just have him tell you about his book. Hello?
Hey there, Frank.
Hey, you're here.
I'm here.
All right. So, how's Washington this evening?
We're under a wind warning. It's storming out tonight. So, Hopefully I won't be cut out mid-sentence.
No. So let's just get into it here. Just tell us about your last book. I know it's been the one I know of in the Neoplasis book, but just tell us how that came about and all.
Well, I was involved in a lot of sort of online poetry things. I've been writing for ages, but earlier it used to be more academic stuff, scholarly articles, that sort of thing. And then, I don't know, 2005, 2006, whenever the whole MySpace thing was going on, I started posting some things online and came to the attention of Dale Winslow and Neoplasis Press, and they wanted to do a book with my work. So that's essentially how that came about. So never let anyone tell you that there's no point to posting that stuff online. It's been a while since the last book, largely because I've been working on my prose. I've got a crime novel I'm working on right now that I'm trying to pitch to Hardcase. And that's been a long process, and that's a whole other story. But that's kind of why I've been not as much of a presence in the poetry circles as I used to be. I still hit, you know, local poetry nights and things like that, and publish little bits here and there, like in Poetic Pinup Review and similar magazines.
Cool.
Wisdom and Dust is sort of a, I don't know, it was the product of about 4 years of my poetry. And it's it does sort of have a overarching theme, although it breaks from that theme several times. There is a organizational principle to it in terms of aspects of different parts of life. All the earlier poems deal with youth, and as it goes on, the last couple of poems deal towards the end of life. But
so why don't you just start in with one?
Okay, will do. The title poem, Wisdom and Dust. Bare knees on cold linoleum, 5-year-old in fervent first prayer, hands clasped, eyes raised, watching the sun glint from dancing dust motes and mistaking them for angels. Sunday school sermon on Solomon, an energetic ingenue of a teacher, said God promised Solomon any one thing, and when Solomon asked for wisdom, he received it. And through wisdom was granted wealth, power, and the love of many women. No fool, our 5-year-old began to pray for wisdom daily. Any prayer is always answered, and as the child entered adulthood, no one dared doubt his intellect. An academic firebrand, ivory towers tremble at the weight of his written word. But the outside world wearies of wisdom. 3 divorces have left him in debt. His children idolize pop stars while he blows dust from his books, watching the motes plummet downward.
Wow, man. That's a great ending.
Thank you.
So, I like the narrative style. I mean, I also enjoy myself. I enjoy language poems sometimes, you know, or I don't know if that's what they're called necessarily, but I do enjoy a nice heavy hitting narrative from time to time. Well, most of the time, but. But so how did, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was at 90% of my stuff is narrative. I mean, I have some formalist stuff. I mean, I have, you know, for a while there, I did a whole bunch of stuff in The Common Measure, doing the Emily Dickinson kind of thing. But most of that stuff doesn't get published, and no one's much interested in it, not even myself. But I do have a ton of narrative work, and most of this book is my narrative verse.
So would you say that, when you were writing academic writing, and now that you're working on in the crime genre, would you say that that earlier stuff that you were writing influenced you to write narrative poetry?
Certainly the influences pop up in here and there. I don't know if it influenced me to write narrative in particular, but certainly all my academic work, in my mind anyway, I sort of disdained the MFAs and creative writing and things like that. And I always just thought, you know, study as much as you can and as wide as you can, and use that in your writing. You learn to write by writing, you know. And so
yeah.
most of my actual studying was in classical history, and I did, you know, a lot of English lit, but it was studying the literature rather than studying your own writing. So I don't know, there's bits and pieces, particularly in the classical stuff, that pops up from time to time, but yeah, it's not really why I chose the narrative form. I think I'm just sort of, well, actually I do know how I chose the narrative form. A lot of my poems from this time period were an exercise to kind of, I made a promise to myself to keep writing, particularly in terms of for the novels that I had in my mind. And whenever I was working out something in the novel, I had made this promise to keep writing for, you know, X number of hours a day, no matter what. So I'd fill up that space by writing these poems. And so a lot of them were exercises in storytelling concision. I wanted to tell as much story as I could in as small a space as possible. So that's actually where a lot of these come from. So that probably answers your question better than the other one in terms of where the narrative inspiration is.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just like wondering, in your perspective, do you think that, because it seems that, I mean, I can't pinpoint a time, it was probably long before my time of being on this earth, but do you think that it's just goes with the way that people speak now, or do you think that's why, like, it sells more so than, say, now, I don't want to say, like, Walt Whitman, because he's one of the kings, but, you know, as opposed to, like, what you might learn in, like, 12th grade English class and poems, you know, do you think it's because, like, it speaks to people in the modern language now?
No, well, most of the rhythmic and formalist stuff, you know, it comes from, you know, a pre-writing period where people needed that stuff in order to memorize large blocks of text.
Mm-hmm.
And then as writing, so that's all ancient history, sort of. So that's, you know, why they were doing all these highly structured meters as a mnemonic aid. And then as writing came along, they're just playing around with things you can do with the text. And that develops and develops and develops. And now we're, you know, it's almost that this is society as a whole is moving away from text and, you know, more towards visual and sound and that sort of thing. So it is getting back to that. But there's, you know, there's still a place for formalist stuff too, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, like, on my bookcase itself has got, like, just straight narrative poetry all the way to, like, something like Dream Songs by Berryman or something. There's, I mean, I like a bit of it all, like, you know, but, you know, I tend to find myself in more of a free verse or narrative thing when I write personally, but I don't know.
Well, why don't I skip ahead to
okay,
another one. This one's called Sharking. I couldn't help but stare at that ass in the Polaroid on the wall. That woman's rear was plenty pink, pleasingly plump, and perfectly pulchritudinous. The drool-worthy vision was marred by the aged frat boy, poised and puckered to kiss the dreamy derriere. A trophy of sorts, the picture was pinned to the pool tournament bulletin board. The men's league champ had lost to the ladies' league counterpart. That kiss didn't seem like much of a penalty, but the pick let me know that I could make money at this bar. They'd bet on anything. I'll pass on the pool tables, too much true talent out there, and the money was stale. The newly inaugurated trivia tourney would best suit my skills. Most of the players' mettle was untested, and a fresh game always meant more money. You can't make cash without a couple of shills, so I brought along a couple of bar buddies and pub pals. Doug's dented head draws stares at the sign-up sheet. A tractor accident as a teen left him seeming simple. At over 450 pounds, Sean has trouble finding a seat, yet won't stop rattling on about roller coasters he'll never be thin enough to ride again. They're not fast friends, but as long as I keep the booze flowing, they're as loyal as dogs. The games begin, the questions start. We decide to keep the con simple. I purposely play pathetic, confusing Stallone with Willis, Hemingway with Gogol. Doug and Sean hoot and howl as I lose beggarly bets to the two. A little later, the cash amounts climb and game gamblers join our circle. I let the moneyed suckers lead early and easy, coming back in the late rounds and letting them take the mid-level stakes. I cry and cajole, claim it was close and beg for bigger bets. Sensing a sure thing, the suckers set it up, and then the hammer falls. Catiline conspired on the street of the scythe makers. Kubrick held the killing, and Sonny Liston liked leopard skin coats. People pale at my trivia prowess. Some players are positively apoplectic. A solid shutout, a windfall win, cash only, no checks. Settled up to the bar, I celebrate with Sean and Doug. Back from the bathroom, a red-faced Mark shouts, "Shark!" and seeks to stare me down. I smile, shrug, and go back to my booze. It's last call, and my companions head home. Pleased with my performance, I'm parking lot bound, when an unseen presence pins me, then my face to the wall. He kicks my kidneys. A timely bartender breaks up the brawl, and I avoid the sight of the surly sucker as I creep to my car, avoiding the possibility of cops and questions. The evening's evaluation at my apartment reveals a tidy $1,000 and the likelihood of pissing blood for a few painful days. A typical take, but perhaps I'd better wait a week before attempting to pad my paycheck again.
Yeah, so is there a backstory to that?
No. I've lived a little bit of that. I mean, I haven't done that much sharking, but I've done things like that before. But there's no specific incident or specific routine to it that inspired that.
Yeah, that was pretty good. That's you got some good storytelling there. So I'm going to move on to the next. I'll just get this question out of the way. And the one I ask everybody is your view on the internet and writing, good or bad or double-edged sword?
Oh, well, it's certainly a double-edged sword. I mean, it's the advantage of being a populist form. I mean, everyone has access to it. Everyone can post things. It's easy as hell to self-publish now. It's easy as hell to publish in e-books now. There's tons and tons and tons of content providers providing their stuff for nothing. But in the multitude of information there, of course, there's less portals to vet these things, so you have a lot more crap. And it's also hard to as an individual wade through the crap to get to the good stuff. So there's plenty of good stuff that's being self-published and good stuff that's coming out through these more populist things, but there's just not as many techniques to really sort through it, and it's a lot of work to do it on your own. So that's the issue, the problem with all the writing on the internet, and the benefit of it too.
Yeah,
that's a lot of voices, man.
Yeah, that is a lot of voices, because it's there's a lot of people that would, let's say, you know, would write anything to have a book, like, you know, without crafting it in any kind of way, I suppose. You know, I'm not saying like the craft of the poem necessarily, but they'll just write anything. So I think it's kind of like a double-edged sword as well. I've always felt that way, because without it, I wouldn't have met certain people or, you know, found out about readings or anything such as that, you know, so whatever. But, film. You seem to be, from what I notice, a big film nut, as myself in a way. Does the film in anywhere, is that just a medium for you to enjoy, or does that influence your writing at all in any kind of way? I know some people where it does.
Oh, well, it certainly pops into my writing a lot. I mean, I dedicated a large portion of my life to film. I managed a movie theater for 10 years, and even after that, I kept my hand in it and helped out with some, like, non-profit little art house films out in the sticks that bring cinema to the Philistines of the world. So yeah, no, I'm still very involved with film in all its forms, and it certainly pops up for a while. There's a big empty period in my publishing history, which was when I was writing a lot of screenplays and turning them in. I had managed to get one optioned once, which is actually my biggest paycheck from any writing I ever did. But they optioned it because they were developing something similar. And they were buying up all the interesting screenplays that were like their film to kill it. So my biggest sale of anything I've ever wrote, with the biggest amount of money, was actually so no one would ever know that it existed.
Well, you could actually kind of frame that screenplay, I suppose.
You've probably gotten a bigger
payday than anyone I've ever known. Well, at least in the poetry world. But I've heard that from my novelist friends that it's actually much harder to publish the novel than it is the poems, the collections of poems. Your take?
It depends on what route you go. But yeah, I mean, in terms of traditional publishing houses, it's sort of much harder to get noticed. Especially with all the self-publishing stuff going out there these days and so many people doing it. And so a lot of the bigger publishing houses do a lot of farming of the MFA programs and stuff. So that's, you know, that ends up being a major reason why they exist, is to make contacts to get into getting your writing out there. But it's not the only way. I mean, and to be perfectly honest, if you manage to get a novel down, that's still way more than most people, and you usually find someone in the, you know, in the traditional publishing world to at least give it a look if you, you know, work at it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that whole MFA route, because I think half the people on my bookshelf are college dropouts. So, but it seems that with the e-books and the e-readers, those things that I don't own, the whole thing is changing, whether it be for poetry or novels or whatever, kind of the written word in general. It's books are being wiped out. I don't know if they'll be forever wiped out, but I could imagine what 50 years from now what it's going to be like. So I don't know, but why don't you give us another poem?
Alrighty, actually, just read one of yours earlier today about a saint card.
Oh,
that reminded me, actually. I have one about a saint card, too, so I thought I'd just throw that in there today. titled poem is Saint Malverde. Prayer cards plastered about the cockpit, and the Cessna purrs under the radar across the border. Jesus Malverde, a charismatic campesino, came down from the mountain and traded his machete for a pistol. Jesse James and our man Jesus made their bones and reaped their reputations in the same generation, albeit on separate sides of the border. The impoverished rooted for them like Robin Hood, although they never seemed to get around to giving their gains to the poor. A short runway savant, the pilot pauses to kiss the Saint medallion before braving a landing on a mere 300 feet of meadow. There is no sin in Sinaloa save having no money, so when a pistol-packing peasant made pesos aplenty, bleeding avaricious dons dry, the people prayed when he passed and suggested sainthood to a nonplussed church. The petition rejected. The chapel of St. Jesus Malverde was built without Rome's gold, on the blood and sweat of the destitute and desperate. 150 years later, the pilot takes a recreational toot for a job well done. No DEA or double-crossing dealers, just a simple transaction, smooth as silk. On the return trip, he utters a prayer of thanks to the only soul in heaven he knows would understand. St. Jesus Malverde, patron saint of drug smugglers.
Yeah, that's my growing up, the images of the saints and stuff like that were like all over my house, like on those like cheap velvet rugs kind of things that you hang on the wall. I don't know, just something like I could never forget. And I always enjoy a nice saint card or saint medallion poem, just images that I got in my head all my life, and I'm not even religious, but they seem to bring some sort of joy or memory to me. So.
Yeah, I was weirded out that there was a saint of drug. I mean, there really is a Jesus Malverde shrine, and he really was a Jesse James kind of gunslinger down in Mexico. And he is the patron saint of drug smugglers. There, you can get medallions and cards and all that sort of stuff. None of it, of course, approved by the church, but they exist. Yeah. There's cartel guys down in Mexico praying to him now.
Yeah, and there's probably a guy hanging from some chains getting electrocuted behind them after they pray, too. I don't know. But so if anybody wants to call in, you can do so. We are at 34 minutes left point. So if you'd like to call in and ask Neil a question about his book or anything, feel free to do so. Phone lines have been a bit quiet the past 2 or 3 weeks. I used to get like much more callers, but people have been shying away. So we'll see if anyone calls. But do you have any, are you writing any poetry at all now or just the book itself?
Oh yeah, I've just slowed down. I never stop. I've slowed down, and also I don't post my stuff publicly as often. I still submit them to journals and whatnot, but I'm a little under the radar these days. But that changes. I'm sure it will change again. I mean, like I said, I've got Harleen's little magazine, the Poetic Pinup Review, that pairs the pinups with similarly themed poetry.
Yeah.
I've had a piece in every issue of that one since it debuted earlier this year. So, and those are all new. So.
Yeah, that's cool. I kind of agree with that. Like I still share the poems sometimes, but myself, like when I get in the magazines, I don't like busting all over Facebook because that's all that Facebook seems about these days is either politics or someone's poetry publication. So, you know, it's a cool thing when people get published, but, you know, I don't know. The older I get, it becomes more of a secluded kind of thing, I think. Like, I don't give a shit about the rest of the world knowing anymore. Is it that way with you at all? Or?
Oh, well, yes and no. I mean, I have my moments. I still promote, you know.
Yeah.
I'm still pretty excited when anything comes out.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah,
I mean, so, I mean, my biggest kick, and more than anything else, was I did a couple local readings, and a couple local bookstores were carrying my book, and I went to my local coffee stand in the morning to grab my morning coffee, and I found one of the baristas reading my book there. She wasn't someone I knew or any of stuff. I was just like, oh, wow, it's a complete stranger reading my book. That's awesome. So, yeah, that was pretty
good.
Cool.
Definitely a good feeling.
That was a
good feeling. So, how can people get your book if they decide they would enjoy getting it?
Well, it's always nice to get it directly from the publisher. So, Neopoesis, you can certainly get it through them, which, of course, that's a pain in the ass to spell, but it's N-E-O. Yeah, you're published through them, too, so look up Frank's book, too, later. Neopoesis. And then of course there's Amazon, which is, Barnes and Noble carry, you know, get a hold of it too. Pretty much all the major internet places to get them. Barnes and Noble, Amazon, Powell's.
What is cool about the internet world nowadays is you can go to any bookstore in the world and they can just order it from their computer.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, you didn't have that 20 years, like 10 years ago even. You had to like take way forever, but you could like go to a library even and see if they'd order it for you. But so I find that to be a good tool in a way. But yeah, that's the most pain in the ass thing to spell. And to this day I got my second book coming out with them, and it's been 3 years since I've been working with them. And to this day, every single time I type their name, I have to make sure it's spelled correctly.
But, well, my classical studies made it a little easier for me, but
it's kind of like trying to spell Mississippi for the first time in like third grade or something. But anyway, so why don't you give us another poem?
Yeah, here's a little bit more abstract one.
Okay.
It's entitled "The Tedious Responsibilities of the Protagonist." Could have danced with the buxom girl of Russian winter eyes, but he doesn't dance any more than Steve McQueen would drive a Prius. Real world worries are beyond his grasp. Frightened of paper tigers, he pulls on the tails of dragons the better to kick them in the nuts. The whimsy of cloud-hopping heroines has been ground up in the gears of the God machine, and audience expectation has him there, ready to make them a sandwich after they fall. Aristotle's ghost yelled at me to start this piece in medias res. I'm not sure I give a shit, but I did it anyway, and the protagonist doesn't seem to mind. He knows it's all in the telling.
Yeah. So, when you write the more of the abstract ones, does this come from, like, thoughts or visions, or do you, like, sit down and it just kind of comes out like that?
And that was just a combination of, I almost hate to reveal my secret in that one, but that was just, I was reading Aristotle while listening to Tori Amos, and that popped out, so.
Well, it's, you never know where you're going to get.
And there's plenty of references to both in that if one wants to look for them.
Well, there's always, like, you can find influence or not influences or inspiration from the weirdest places. That's where I find it from. Like, I never really find it for reading a book per se. I find it walking down the street or like you did, listening to music and something, reading a book and whatever. Like, I don't know. But yeah, that's cool, man. So when did this writing craze come about? Like, when did it start? As a child? You have to tell the history now.
Oh, well, as far as I know, I've always wanted to write. It's interesting. In my family, the more extended family with all the cousins and all that sort of stuff, I was, you know, it's kind of funny with the whole patriarchal lineage kind of thing. I always felt like I was the odd one out because I wasn't quite the favored son of my grandfather, who my paternal grandfather was old school mountain man. He was, you know, he came over on the boat from Scotland when he was like three. He did, you know, they homesteaded in northern Idaho, and he did surveying work in Alaska in the 20s. And he was a lumberjack, and he was just, you know, an old school man's man. And a lot of my other sort of cousins very much wanted to be like that. They were all hunting, camping, very, very mas macho in that group. And I was kind of, you know, my grandfather just sort of largely ignored me. I mean, for large portions of my life, he kept referring me to me by the name of one of my cousins. He could never be bothered to remember my name. He kept calling me Steve. which is the cousin that was the most like what he kind of wanted us to be. But the funny thing is, when I was griping about this, I was griping about this to my father, and my father's like, "You've got no reason to complain," because my grandfather liked most of the cousins and kind of ignored me. But on the other side, my grandmother from that side of the family only liked me. And apparently was kind of obnoxious about it. And they were the strangest married couple ever, in the sense that they were worlds apart. My grandmother was a college professor associate professor. She didn't get her full stuff, but she was a female professor in the 30s, teaching kinesiology. And she was very much the intellectual and book learning type. And she just, you know, doted on me. And I very much thrived under that. I just read a million books at much higher reading levels than I know stuff, and all I really wanted to do was just be part of that world. And it didn't really matter that it was necessarily the fiction or the arts, or whether it was the sciences, or whether it was, you know, I just was very much, the world of academia was very important to me, largely because of her.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that comes from. But, I mean, as far as I can tell, my desire to write and be part of that and have books, and that's just is bone deep. It comes from, like, pre-memory.
Cool. That's one thing I've noticed when I haven't asked this question to everybody, but one thing that always comes up was if somebody who's creative, whether in this case writing because of the show, that it tends to start at a very young age, whether they go through with it starting young or it happens later, it was always something prior to memory. So just, do you think that people are just born with that gift, or is that something that can be worked on and made into, like, a gift or something?
Oh, well, I mean, there's a bit of both. I mean, it's not just nature or just nurture, but I think nurture is probably more important. I mean, nature is what it is. People are going to have certain amount of gifts, but, you know, the most gifted guy ain't crap if he doesn't have the right environment and the right, you know, right work ethic and right way of working at it. At the same, you know, whereas you don't need to take much talent to polish it into something interesting. There has to be some. There are some people that can't polish,
yeah.
But it doesn't take much to polish into something interesting. So, but there's way more natural talent squandered than there is, you know, non-talents thriving, I think.
Yeah, I think that you're probably right. I don't think that anybody's necessarily born. I don't think anybody's going to be born and write some amazing piece of literature just yet. I think you definitely have to work at it a bit. I think some people are just born sensitive to those things in a way, as opposed to maybe your cousin Steve, who is probably a lumberjack.
Man, Steve, I don't know. He was a photographer for National Geographic. He traveled the world. He's a ski instructor around Tahoe. I mean, he looks like a male model. Steve's just annoying. He's got a pretty blessed life, man. He's a cool cat.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't really dislike him. That's the thing. Is you hang out with him and he's awesome. But yeah, I still have a burning childhood envy about him sometimes.
Well, wow, he just comes out and I didn't know he was a National Geographic photographer. I kind of like Steve already.
he wasn't a professional photographer. He actually dumbassed his way into they were recreating like Cook's Voyage around Australia and stuff at the same time he was like bumming around back there, and they needed some help. They had like a sailing, you know, tall ship, sailing vessel that they were recreating it with, and they lost one of their sailors. They needed to become an extra sailor, and he knew how to sail. And then once he was on the ship with them, he also was like, "Yeah, I'm also a photographer." And then he ended up getting some of his stuff published, and you know that's how his life goes.
Well, I don't know. I guess everybody
awesome.
Kind of knows. I guess everybody kind of has a Steve in some way in their family, but I just thought that's a kind of funny story that you told. I'm kind of glad you told that story about your grandfather.
Oh, yeah.
But
I mean, certainly
you should probably write a poem about that one day.
Oh, man, I have tried writing poems about my grandfather. That doesn't ever work. I've tried directly confronting that little bugaboo, that hobgoblin. But yeah, it hasn't popped out yet. It might someday.
So you can give us another poem now if you'd like.
I want to do a longer one.
That's fine, go ahead.
This is just sort of a bring the house down kind of one.
Okay.
Fuck Buddies Don't is the title. She's dead now. When I met her, I'd already learned the hard lessons of my heart, the soul deep savior syndrome that led me to dally with the damaged. I'd vowed no more romance with the wounded, but slave to my psyche, I still sought to save, and sex was possible, provided the understanding that nothing deeper could occur. From my side of the bar, I heard the complaints long before I saw her. Women whispered words like skank, slut, and whore, while the men were mad that a poor pool player had taken up too much time at the tables. Typically armed with beer and book, I braved the pool room. Her presence screamed spectacle. Clad only in a large men's wife beater and a dainty pair of Doc Martens, she showed her center whenever she stretched across the table to scratch a shot. Blood-red lips on a shaved head laughed loudly at the grief given by redneck pool hustlers angry at her horsing around. I returned to my reading and a little writing until her improbably purple eyes caught me smiling at her antics and she launched herself into my lap. You're the only one here man enough to fuck me. I imagine that's true. We drove back to my place, passing work lights in the industrial park. She sought to shock me and whispered that straight sex bored her. All she wanted was ass and mouth and perhaps some fun with fists. With eyebrow cocked, I shrugged, and she giggled, "You'll do just fine." 5 minutes after arriving at my apartment, she lay half on and half off of my couch, t-shirt off and boot-clad feet spread wide, snoring, and perfectly passed out. I laughed, went to my office, and worked on a screenplay until dawn. She's dead now. A couple of weeks went by without words exchanged from either direction. Then, with a bolt of telephonic lightning, she invites me to dinner. I almost didn't recognize her as she came to the car from the coffee shop where I paused to pick her up. She was dressed in a 1920s idea of the exotic East, complete with a Thetabara-style turban covering her punkish shaved skull. I followed her directions to a faux Victorian mansion deep in the woods. This was not the restaurant I had been expecting, but she quieted my queries with a blowjob while we remained parked in the circular driveway. I spent the evening stammering, stuttering, and smiling like a simp as she introduced me to her parents, sister, and other relatives I can't recall. Feeling awkward and alien, dinner passed in geologic time, and when finished, I cornered the comely agent of chaos who had led me here. My divorce did me in. I don't do drama. I'm your friend and part-time fuck, but I can't be more than that. She snorted and said I was stupid. She only wanted someone stable to dine with her family the night before they forced her into rehab. She's dead now. I wrote to her in rehab. I wrote of friends and family and even my hard-to-talk-about ex-wife and their experiences in similar circumstances. I wrote that the world could be bigger than her addictions or rehab solutions if she wanted it to be. She wrote back in a painfully labored grammar. Without reading a word, each unsteady letter seemed to scream, "I'm trying my best here." She wrote of boredom and secret sexual acts with tattooed chola. She illustrated the latter with comically executed sketches. The letters continued and revealed the boredom to be true, but the sex to be less so. Ultimately, she asked me to pick her up from the facility because no one else would. She's dead now. Weeks after her release, she came to me and announced she would be an actress. She seemed to treat this as if she had simply applied to work at Starbucks. A community theater was holding auditions for a production of Romeo and Juliet. She needed me to make sense of Shakespeare for her. Dropping by daily, without drink, drugs, or even the suggestion of sex, she studied hard, and I was happy to work in a field that I had been trained for. One day, the dam broke, and her brain was flooded with understanding. She felt she could read any Elizabethan verse and get it. Made raccoon-like by tear-traced mascara, she kissed and hugged me with great fervor before leaving to sign up for the audition. I don't know the details, but she never got the part. Time tumbled along, and I seldom saw her, hearing only that she now lived with the Tongan dealer of crystal and coke, a man famous for his ability to remain motionless. A rare reading of a local rag informed me she had been picked up by the police. I sighed with unsurprise as I tossed the paper aside. She's dead now. time taunts and troubles on occasion, there's no doubt that it passed differently for me and for her, twixt my reading the paper and the arrival of the envelope. It was large, stuffed near to bursting, and it had arrived from the women's penitentiary in Purdy. Polaroids poured forth from the scissor-ripped top, and I paused in worried wonder, knowing that no such package would be allowed to leave the prison. Impossibilities aside, I gathered up her gift. The photos were artless nudes, each and every one. She was emaciated, with the ribs of a starving desert dog. The close confines and institutional colors only added to the sense of dehumanization. An animal penned. Her glassy eyes burned through the film with cold fire while she bent and contorted in various poses, seeking to bare her soul through gynecological exam. The short accompanying letter was sodden with soap opera sentiment, empurpled declarations of love and promises to make me happy. I jumped as if bit, and feverishly struggled to quickly write a reply, as if my speed in writing would be reflected by the post office. I hoped what I wrote was consoling, commiserating, yet clever enough to leave her with a laugh, but most importantly, I hoped to make it clear that I was just a fuck buddy. 2 weeks passed too soon, and another envelope arrived, almost as thick as the one before. It opened to reveal sheets upon sheets of pulp-textured paper scrawled upon with what seemed to be charcoal. A heart-rattling list, it read, "Fuck buddies don't write girls in rehab. Fuck buddies don't teach Shakespeare to fuck-ups. Fuck buddies don't stand up for sluts in sports bars." And on it went for hundreds of entries. I couldn't write back. I'd feel sick when I tried. And the day I heard of her overdose, I cried for days, upset at the relief I felt for not having to face her.
Wow. That was really good, man. I was, like, really into that character there. Is this a real person?
Yeah, it's about three or four real people smooshed into one.
Yeah.
Two of them are no longer with us, and two of them are still alive and much happier than the person in the poem.
Yeah, I got pretty involved with wanting to know what was going to happen. You already said that she had passed in the poem, but I was waiting to see. I like getting involved in poems like that sometimes. That was a good one, man. And what was that one called again?
Fuck buddies don't.
I like that part at the end when she wrote back in the charcoal. That was good. I don't know. I'm a little blown away by that.
Yeah, that's what I would say is sort of the house bringer. It brings down the house. It's hard to. I can't do that one too often. A, it's longer than most of the open mic sort of stuff, but it's also a difficult one to read sometimes too.
Yeah, sometimes those poems are types of things that remind me when Hemingway said writing's nothing more than what did he say? I'm probably paraphrasing, but cutting open your wrists at the typewriter or something like that. I don't know. I like when a poem does that to me. I mean, when you take difficult things and make them sound beautiful in a way, even if they're difficult. But I think that that's kind of one of the main purposes in a way. I don't think that, I don't know.
Well,
it doesn't, straightforward
in a way. Helps
you look
at things that are otherwise difficult to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely that. So, yeah, that was a good one. But do you have any plans to? I know I kind of asked this earlier in a way, but do you have any plans to put together another collection of poetry, or is that just something that is just going to happen whenever you're done prose writing?
Well, I honestly don't know. I have been beginning to pick up more poetry writing, and it almost disturbs me because I feel like I'm getting away from my novel that I'm supposed to be working on. I would like to see another collection, though, and I If I could get over my general dislike for some of my own work, I'd have enough to put one together now. But as it is, through my own little vetting system or the closer circle I have, I've got maybe half a book now. Or, well, actually, it's not true. I'm thinking of a book the same size as mine. Wisdom and Dust is actually a pretty hefty book for a poetry book. I could certainly put out smaller ones right now. But yeah, I'll probably, I don't know, in another month or two, maybe I'll pester Dale and see what she thinks. Dale being our publisher and editor in chief at Neopoesis.
Influences for you. That's another question I ask everybody. A simple question.
I'm all over the place. I mean, you know, as a lit major, as a historian, there's all sorts of things. I mean, whether you can see it in my work or not. I mean, certainly, it becomes apparent to many people that I do have a Bukowski fan club card in my wallet somewhere. But other than that, some of the other influences are probably a little bit, I don't know, harder to see. I mean, Röttke had a big influence on my concept of poetry, but there's very little that I write that's much like Röttke. I mentioned that I've got, you know, notebooks upon notebooks of, you know, Common Measure, Emily Dickinson-like stuff. I don't know what I think of that material. But yeah, certainly there's a place for that as well.
But I think that a lot of times. Oh, sorry.
Oh no, I was really just name checking. I'm trying to think of something I could give you that's a little bit more valuable than just the names.
No, that's fine. That's like I think that a lot of writers, in a way, are influenced by people that you don't sometimes see it in their stuff. Like you said, Bukowski, he was hugely influenced by Robbins and Jeffers, and they write nothing alike. You know, their concept of hating humanity might be likewise, but you know, a lot of people that influence me, I write nothing like them. So, you know, I think that that's an important thing, to get turned on by other things. You know, no one wants to sound like Lee Poe constantly. So, you know, now if I can write like Lee Poe. Go ahead.
I was just saying, you know, all my years as a professional academic, or, you know, perpetual student, more like, you know, I've got more credits in Shakespeare than any reasonable human should. But I don't know how much Shakespeare pops out in anything I write, you know. It's certainly in there somewhere.
Oh yeah,
and
so is
everything else.
Yeah, it all comes together, but with your own, like, I think it's always important to tell your own story, whether it's you're writing fiction or truthful poems. I think it's kind of like the person should always come out. Like I was once told by somebody, I don't know if this is true in a way, because someone once told me that nothing's original anymore. But I think the way you can be original is by telling your story. You know, no one can be you.
Well, that's as well as a lot of people, when they want to tell, say, get at a universal truth, when their purpose is to try to get a universal truth, their mistake is to then write about the universal. The only way that you can get at a universal truth in a way that other people can understand is to approach it through the personal.
Yeah.
All the big ones that really, really sort of hit on those things are, like, you know, Dostoevsky's Brother Karamazov. That's probably one of the most, you know, serious works of examinations of human ethics and human morality, but it's a very real personal story of those three brothers, you know?
Yeah.
And it couldn't be otherwise. You couldn't have it couldn't hit those universal truths except if it didn't come through the personal.
Exactly. So we're down to 5 minutes. Do you want to close us out with a poem? Or
I can close out with a poem. Probably change the tone, huh? just to prove I can write goofier stuff. I'll leave off with sort of I'll do a Jimmy Stewart poem. I'll tell you a poem about my dog.
Okay.
Called Butterball and I. Come on, dummy, I say in my best Fred Sanford imitation. Merry and awkward, the furball trundles towards the door. Stubby Lhasa Apso legs carry the plump poodle torso. He gazes up at me while I fasten the leash, all bulging eyes and protruding teeth. I've known him less than a year, yet I'm already tired of the so ugly he's cute description, however apt it may be. He's my girlfriend's dog, but I promise him that I would never deny ownership. I won't want to slight the little mutant. He ignores me as he moves toward the car, rolling forward as if each of his four legs were a different length. I babble at the wee beast as we drive to the park. He ignores me, too excited by the prospect of new adventure, and I'm reminded that the rescued dog had once been perpetually housebound. The pooch practically explodes when confronted with the opportunities the park presents. He strains at the leash, seeking to go all directions at once. In short order, he shits 7 times in 7 different places in as many minutes. Finally freed of earthly affairs, he floats us toward the leash-free portion of the park. Butterball seeks canine society, and this Sunday morning the park is filled with his brethren. I leave the leash on, cautious about BB's lack of social skills, but the new pup at the park is warmly welcomed by mammals of many stripes. He butts head with a bison friche, while his new friend's elderly Asian owner attempts to stuff him full of homemade treats. Black labs and boxers, golden retrievers, and a passel of pint-sized critters with French monikers all sniff and skitter in playful abandon. Butterball joins in, but behaves himself, looking perpetually perplexed that the world could be this wonderful. Eventually, the doggy domination games become a bit much, and I have to extract my pal from a canine group grope. We settle on a saunter around the park's periphery. Encountering dogs and owners one-on-one seemed more our speed. I had half forgotten how humans have their own forms of ass-sniffing domination games. We passed a garrulous gal and her watchful Rottweiler. They soaked in the spectacle of the odd little dog leading my leather jacket-clad, beringed and cigar-smoked smoking self. She suddenly spoke up. What's with all the manly macho shit? Are you compensating for walking a girly dog? Sorry, sister, I replied. Your analysis is unwarranted and unwelcome. Sometimes a guy just likes to smoke a good cigar. We turned across an old horseshoe pitch and were casually accosted by a teen in a trucker cap. He blinked twice at Butterball and asked if I were gay. Sorry, son, I don't swing that way, but I'm sure you'll find a boyfriend someday. He silently summed up the bullying math and decided against any unfortunate action. Short, stubby legs slowed down a pace or two as we started back. A comely co-ed, complete with ponytail and running gear, stopped short at the sight of Butterball. Either you're walking your girlfriend's dog or you're here to pick up girls, she stated with certainty. He belongs to my girlfriend. That's a shame, she said, smiling, and resumed her running. I paused, uncertain how to take the apparent compliment. In the car, I apologized to Butterball for breaking my promise. I'm sorry I didn't acknowledge you, buddy. But you understand how these territorial pissings work. She was sniffing out my lines and limits, and it wouldn't do for her to spread her scent in my yard. Butterball yawned and waited to get back home to Mom.
Well, on that note, man, that was a good one. It was good having you on. We're down to like 10 seconds here. I appreciate
having
you.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. I'm sure I'll see you in the internet world.
Oh, yeah, I'll be in touch, I'm sure.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, good night.
Good night. And that was Neil McRae. You can check out his stuff, Wisdom and Dust, on Neil Poitras Press. It's outstanding stuff, so you should really check it out. But next week, our guest will be Artie Armstrong from Lummox Press. Have a good one.